Hello, everyone.
I'm Carl.
And I'm Em.
And welcome to our podcast discussing all the latest books. This is season 2, episode 11. And today we are discussing I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. As always, we will save our ratings at the very end.
We promise to give you all of our honest opinions on all the characters, chapters, and scenarios. We don't mean any harm to any of the authors. This is solely our opinion. And as always, we promise to Carl and like we read them.
Period. So some trigger warnings for this book include racism and racial slurs, white supremacy and mentions of the KKK, sexism and misogyny, sexual assault of a child, chronic bronchitis, alcohol consumption, smoking, dead bodies, murder, physical assault, ableism, references to being mute due to trauma, traumatic responses, that sort of thing. Can you think of anything else?
I know they mention gambling, underage sex.
They for sure do that.
Prostitution.
There's some, like it mentioned cons. Racism, racial slurs, and predominantly it's about African Americans, but there's also some about Mexicans as well.
And I know there is one section where it's kind of like implied human trafficking or like implied sell of underage girl kind of situation.
Yeah, so as always, just make sure to take care of yourself before diving in. The main triggers for this book are racism focused on African Americans, as it is set back in the days of segregation in her childhood. Most of the book is in the South, so that makes it even worse.
You should also be aware that quotes may be read from this book that could contain language that could be triggering as well.
You should expect spoilers to lie ahead.
If you don't want to hear how this book ends, please pause here, go read the book, and then come back to this episode. Are you ready to get started?
Let's get into it. All right, so the blurb for this book is, here is a book as joyous and painful, as mysterious and memorable as childhood itself. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings captures the longing of lonely children, the brute insult of bigotry, and the wonder of words that can make the world right. Maya Angelou's debut memoir is a modern American classic beloved worldwide. Sent by their mother to live with her devout grandmother in a small southern town, Maya and her brother endure the ache of abandonment and prejudice. At 8 years old and back at her mother's side in St. Louis, Maya is attacked by a man many times her age and has to live with the consequences for a lifetime. Years later in San Francisco, Maya learns that love for herself, the kindness of others, her own strong spirit, and the ideas of great authors will allow her to be free instead of imprisoned. Poetic and powerful, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings will touch hearts and change minds for as long as people read.
The memoir opens in 1931 when 3-year-old Maya arrives in Stamps, Arkansas, along with her 4-year-old brother, Bailey. Their parents recently divorced, sent the siblings to the small southern town to live with their grandmother, Mama Henderson. Mama owns a general store in the black part of Stamps and runs it with the help of her disabled son, Uncle Billy. From an early age, Maya struggles with the feelings of self-doubt, abandonment, and finds solace in books and her brother's company. More mischievous than his sister, Bailey fills their time with new adventures and becomes Maya's best friend and confidant. The town of Stamps is highly segregated, and Maya has minimum contact with the white population, but nevertheless, she regularly witnesses instances of racism. When she watches Mama Henderson hide Uncle Billy from the Ku Klux Klan and sees the white neighborhood girls talk down to her grandmother, Maya is overwhelmed with a strong sense of injustice. Okay, so the first opening starts whenever Maya is reading a poem during the Easter service at a church. While she's reading this poem, she kind of speeds through it because she realizes that she needs to use a restroom. And as she's rushing out the door, she ends up urinating on herself. She runs outside and she feels great freedom. And even though she's aware of the repercussions for having that, she kind of has a little bit of a freedom moment. We also learn a little bit about Bailey, her brother, which is a year older than her, and they are on their way to Stamps, Arkansas, which I had not heard of Stamps before this book. I live in Arkansas, and that was a news thing. I know several other places that they talked about in the book I was aware of, but Stamps is a new one for me.
Same.
And
it's a small little town.
Yeah, so her parents have divorced and they've decided to go and live with their grandmother who owns a store with their uncle, which I was a little weary whenever you had said that there were sexual assault scenes, that it was possibly the uncle. So I was a little like apprehensive in getting to kind of the introductory of him. And especially in several scenes, it kind of seemed like he was a little bit more like chummy with her. But I realized, you know, now finishing where we're at, that it was just kind of being an uncle figure, but I was a little apprehensive.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't know who the individual was that had attacked her. And so I also was really nervous about the uncle.
Yeah.
So I kept just like waiting for the shoe to drop. So when she goes back to St. Louis and it's her mother's boyfriend, I don't think they were married.
I think they were just boyfriend, girlfriend.
Just so you guys know. I feel like that's a common theme for me. Like I knew in The Nightingale, there was sexual assault. So I just like every man that we met, I just kept waiting for it to be him. And yeah. So like, it's kind of nice to know who it is so that you know when to expect it.
Well, and I didn't know like how many either. I didn't know if it was more than one or anything like that too. So I was just like, oh, maybe it's like a lifetime of men that kind of abused her. So I was just kind of waiting for Uncle Willie to be that guy. And I kind of hated it going like through it because he actually did seem like a really big figure in her life of kind of like a protection, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
No, was it actually her uncle or was he like just somebody she called uncle?
No, that was actually their uncle because that was Mama's son.
Okay. I just,
which, I don't know, the way Dad acted, Daddy Bailey, I think is what they called him. The way he acted, I struggled with connecting that to Mama Henderson. Like they just, I couldn't imagine how she was this great and produce such like a uninvolved dad. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the uncle was so great too. So involved. And it was just weird to me. Like it doesn't have to be a direct correlation from her raising. I just mean it just is odd to resonate those two characters as related as mom and son.
No, I definitely understand that. Because it was a little confusing for me too at times. Because I had trouble kind of like keeping up with the family tree. Because it was kind of like, okay, how is that? And then especially whenever they were referring to the grandmother as mama, like that even was like, okay, are we talking about mother or not mother? And then they talked about like the woman on the screen that they said looked like their mother but was a white woman, and it was just like, okay, well now we have this other character. And then they said at one point, I think they said that Bailey was going and watching mama on the screen. I was like, are we watching the fake mama? Are we watching the real mama? Like, is the mama now an actress? Like, I just missed this. Like, it was a little confusing just because of the different references to them.
Yeah, and so it took me a minute to realize that Mama Henderson, I keep putting their last name on there because that's how I differentiated in my brain, that she was Dad's mom. When we first went into it, I don't know why, but I assumed she was Mom's mom.
I did too.
And then when she goes to St. Louis, we find out it's not because Mom's mom is there with her. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. This whole time I thought that was Mom's mom. It's Dad's mom. Not that it really matters, I don't guess, but I don't know. I just, that threw me off to start with. And so then I had to almost like make like a little family tree in my head so I could keep them separate. And then I started adding the last names to really keep them separate.
No, definitely makes sense.
I will say though, and I'll say this more when we get there, just the little touch of her uncles in St. Louis, I think that might have been my favorite part of the story.
There's a scene I found to be my favorite at a dentist's office.
Yes, so I listened to that part. I read like the last bit of it, but I listened to that part. And I was like, wait a minute, that's not what happened? Wait, like I didn't realize, obviously, because when you're listening to it, you're not looking at it. In the book, it's italicized.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you could almost kind of tell that it wasn't real.
Yeah.
Or get a hint, maybe. In your head, you can't. And so, like, I was just listening to her tell a story. And then when she went back and she was like, and Mama told Uncle this or whatever. And then she was like, but I liked my version better. I just paused the book and be like, wait a damn minute. Back up here. What just happened? And then I pulled the book out to see, like, if it looked different in the book. And that's when I realized it was italicized. So that was pretty cool.
So while she is living with Mama, she's often disciplined by Uncle Willie, who has a disability. And apparently, whenever he was 3 years old, his babysitter had dropped him and his left side of his body had become paralyzed. So he does use a cane to walk and he also has a speech impediment. And so like neighbors, some local children and stuff make fun of him. And so he tries not to let his disability rob him of his dignity. And so there is one day that kind of stands out to me where he is in the store and he's pretending to a couple customers that he's not disabled. And they're kind of like out of towners. I don't know if he was like putting on a show for them or if like he knew of them and kind of wanted to impress them. I'm not quite sure. And as her, I think she was like 6 years old at this time. It's kind of hard to say like what that interpretation was.
But I was about to say, I don't feel like we got clarification, and maybe that's because she was a young child, but yeah. I never really understood what was going on there.
Well, and she does make the comment, he must have been tired of being crippled, as prisoners tire of penitentiary bars, and the guilty of the blame. So, I mean, maybe he did at that particular point just want to be normal where nobody has anything to say to him or anything like that.
Yeah.
So one day they are cleaning up the store and the former sheriff comes in to the store to tell Mama that Uncle Willie should lay low that night. He doesn't explain anything, but he says that a black man had messed with a white lady. So the Ku Klux Klan, or the boys as he refers to them, might come to the store later that night and look for Uncle Willie. So Mama hides Uncle Willie in a vegetable bin and he spends the night under potatoes and onions. And they don't end up coming, but basically Maya does come to the realization that if they did end up finding him, that he probably would have been lynched. So that's kind of her first, at least that she's wrote about, instance where it really has kind of resonated with her, the dangers of the color of their skin and kind of what their people have to go through in that town.
Yeah. So, I would say hiding in that potato and the way she described it, like, to me, I just imagined like how suffocating it would feel.
Yeah.
Especially, my chest hurt. I mean, my chest hurt because the KKK got referenced and they're potentially coming after Uncle Willie. But also imagining like laying under that all night.
Well, and just like the anticipation of whether or not something was going to happen or not too. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, they're going to drop by at 5 o'clock. They're not there. So you're good. It's all night long, just waiting for that shoe to drop and, you know, something to happen. And honestly, especially in this time period, there wasn't really like a justice system to these kind of crimes. It was just whoever they thought or best fit the bill, they would, you know, do something to. So unfortunately, I don't think there would have been any chance for him to say, hey, it wasn't me.
Absolutely.
So in the next chapter, we kind of get into a little bit more of Maya's observations, the people surrounding her. She talks about how different people wear different kind of clothing. Some people, because they kind of have more of an independence, is how she refers to it as. They stand out in the community. Some of them wear suits. Some of them just wear handmade clothing. And she talks about how they're all really kind of tightly knit and they help each other out no matter what their standing is. They kind of have a small talk with every person they meet. It's a very friendly town that they're in. But a lot of the children, Maya refers to saying that they didn't really know what whites look like because their town was so segregated from the rest of the area. Several of them were not even allowed to leave the area to go into what they call White Folksville. They have strict rules that they have to follow. They have to stay clean, keep the store clean. They have very disciplined upbringings. Speaks into it later on how it's almost like they are told to have really good education skills. However, when it comes down to it, she's also kind of put in a corner of don't push your education down on people. Like, you speak too differently than the rest of the people here, especially after she had gone off and come back. So even though she's kind of pushed to be like smart, she's also told not to show that to people. So it's kind of like a double whammy in a way.
That was an interesting, what's the word? Not theory, but just like an interesting part of the plot. Like, as we went through the story, seeing the different ways that education was talked about and experienced by her, and in the different areas and the different time periods, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Every place we went, we got to see that. And I thought that was something that was interesting. Like I said, that's not what I thought originally the book was going to be about. I thought it was going to be about her life, but I kind of thought it was going to be more about, this is kind of morbid, but like all of the bad things. And like, that's like just a near constant of bad things. And it wasn't. It was a very beautiful story, I thought, the way she told it. And she intertwined it all to make it a full life story as opposed to, you know what I mean? But
yeah, definitely.
But education was something that she kept coming back to, and I found that really interesting, and the different ways that she experienced it in each area, and like the different sort of teachers, and like what it meant for her, even individually.
And different type of teachings as well. Like, you know, one lady taught her kind of the proper way of presenting herself. One lady taught her her love of books, and her grandma kind of taught her the way of like taking care of herself and being independent. And so I found it pretty interesting to see like the different types of things that presented itself and how it presented itself.
Like even like teaching outside of school too, like you said, the Mrs. Flowers that talked to her about poetry and stuff. But like grandma teaching her math before she even went to school, or you know, those sort of things. Like it was just really interesting to see that, like, the education play a thread from start to finish, especially in this era, especially for a young Black girl. Like, I just thought that was a really interesting way to, it's almost like I don't know. I don't want to say that's almost like the journey that we took with was her education, but you could see how much it meant to her and how much it impacted her. And that was really neat.
Yeah. So one predominant thing in the first couple chapters that I do want to speak about is the white children that had come to the store, the white girls that had basically mocked her grandmother, and her composure she kept the entire time. I don't think I would have been able to keep the composure she did, but I'm sure that this was probably not the first time, unfortunately, that this happened to her. And so she's just sitting there humming a hymn the entire time, and she still addresses them respectfully, you know, whenever they're going to leave. But Maya is just really not sure or doesn't understand why she would withstand such humiliation and not reprimand the girls, because obviously if Maya would have done the same thing, she probably would have been. It just kind of is a realization in her life where she does end up stating that Mama was the one who emerged victorious because she maintained her dignity by not showing out and, you know, making a scene and things like that. So definitely kudos to her, because I definitely would have not been able to do it.
Wholeheartedly agree. And I thought it was interesting to get Maya's perspective in that as a young girl, because like in my brain, I would have assumed that like that sort of lesson of self-preservation would have been taught already to her at that age. So it was interesting to see that she didn't even understand it at that point still, and she was like probably one of her first moments of learning it, and then obviously with Uncle Willie also. But like it was in a very sad, obviously, kind of way, seeing her come to the realization of what the world really is too at that time.
Absolutely. Well, I do want to say that as well, the pastor that comes by, Reverend Thomas, that starts coming to dinner, he also got introduced, especially because that often happens in kind of some of these scenarios, especially when they're making house calls, almost like paying special attention to the children. Sometimes that could, you know, further. So I was just like, oh, great. But I did find it weird that he like drops by every week. He just like, they always have food waiting for him. Just like, I don't know. To me, I guess, I don't know if this is normal in that time period. Like, this is the first time I've ever read anything set in this time period that had this kind of instance where it was almost like a weekly thing where their reverend came by. And it was almost like he made house calls to everybody in town.
I think that might be more of a cultural thing.
Okay.
I think that might be what that is.
I just, even then, I've not read any books prior in the past where that kind of had been referenced.
How many books have you read about African Americans and their religious culture?
Well, not just like religion, but like whenever they have like stories about the childhood, like, I mean, it's not, I've not read a lot of fiction as far as say, but like nonfiction, you know, I've read maybe three or four other nonfiction books, but usually the fiction books usually don't have any kind of reference to anything like that happening either in like the flashbacks or things like that.
I don't think I've read any other books where like it would have occurred or been talked about. So I don't guess I've ever had that thought. I was shocked that Mama had a store that was Mama's and Mama was in charge and Mama had the financial stability to even help out others of white and Black races. And so I don't know if maybe that played into it and that's why the Reverend came around, because I didn't expect that at all. I was very shocked.
I almost feel like maybe, and you can cut this out if you want to, but I almost kind of felt like it was like almost like for gossip. Like he was coming Because obviously she runs a store, so she would be coming, she'd be hearing a lot of things that were going on. So, like, he was coming to get the local gossip before he taught his sermon, so he knew what he needed to be speaking about on Sunday.
I would not, listen, and I do not mean this as an insult at all, but I would not put it past a pastor to be like, all right now, ladies, tell me what y'all heard about the town so I can let them know what they need to be doing better.
We have several customers that are pastors, and all of them can... When they walk in the door and we get to chit-chatting, I promise you they will tell me everything under the sun about their entire congregation if I asked them.
Pastors in general are nosy. Like, yeah. And I get it, because like, that is how you serve your congregation, is to know about them. So like, I don't mean it as an insult, but they are. They're nosy. They want to know what's going on in your life. How can they make it better? How can they teach you to be better? Like, that's always the undertone of every conversation.
So we enter the Great Depression, which ends up hitting their town.
The way you just read that, I'm sorry. So we enter the Great Depression. It's like a museum guide, and we're like walking along the wall in the timeline.
The timeline.
I know, it's just funny. So we enter the Great Depression.
If I just say the store is struggling, then that's just a random fact.
I know, it's just funny. I think it's great that you're setting the era and the atmosphere.
Okay.
Whatever word you want to use, but I just think it's funny the way you said it.
So we entered the Great Depression and didn't believe that it would ever affect their community, but then it starts affecting it. I think they even referred to it as something that's going to affect only the white lives, or, you know, things like that. And I mean, to be honest, her comparison is probably true to the facts that they're already extremely poor as far as most of that community, so it's not going to affect them as greatly because they don't have a whole lot. It does start affecting them because obviously at some point the money trickles down. And so a lot of her store's customers can't afford to buy food from her, so she comes up with a way to not go bankrupt. She almost allows them to trade their rations. So almost they bring in a box of this, they get two of this kind of situation. They do talk about how they eat powdered milk and powdered eggs quite often, which I've never had either, but the way she described it, it did not sound good at all.
I don't like eggs anyways. I certainly don't want powdered eggs.
No.
And the fact that she was able to help out her town and her people by bargaining and doing that sort of thing with the store is, honestly, I would imagine unheard of in this time period.
Well, we also find out later on that a white dentist had borrowed money from her as well around this time period. So to me, that was also a big thing, because there was a high chance that he could have said, hey, I never borrowed any money from you. I don't know what you're talking about. And really, I don't know what would have been done if that wasn't the case. But then at the same time, it's a white man going to a black woman for help. So, you know, that's almost like unheard of at this point in time as well. But I did find that pretty significant to how high up Mama is in the community that she lives in, but also kind of how well off she is compared to kind of what it seems like. Based off the descriptions, she talks about her clothing and the things that she has and stuff like that. It doesn't seem like they are, but I mean, for that kind of thing to happen, it kind of seems to raise that. And they may have honestly not wanted to live and presented themselves well off just because that could have added more attention to them.
Yeah, just like in this era, women in general, like, couldn't own property. Mm-hmm. Your money wasn't your money. Your children weren't your children. Like, we were property ourselves still. So I was astonished. And to be quite frank, I would like a story about Mama's life to figure out how she got there. Like, was she married and her husband passed away and that's how she got the property? Is it in Willie's name and we just don't talk about that, you know, because Maya was a child and doesn't know those sort of things?
Yeah, that was kind of my assumption, was that it was on Uncle Willie's name and she just kind of took it over. But that to me would make the most logical sense of kind of the timeline and kind of why he's still around and hasn't left kind of situation.
Well, I don't think he's left, because it talks about at one point when Mama took them to California that he had never not been with his mom. He was 35 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all he's ever known anyways. But yeah, it was interesting. I would have liked to hear more about that.
Well, and shortly after as well, Maya and Bailey received Christmas presents from their parents, who she actually had believed at this point in time that they were dead, because she just could not in her mind justify why she sent them away. So she does get a little bit emotional over the presence and kind of the realization that they're not dead. But they then kind of conclude, as young children often come to their own conclusions, that their mother was angry with them and the presence meant basically she'd forgive them and they would be back at some point.
Isn't that so sad?
It is.
On top of everything else they're having to deal with, they believe that their parents didn't want them.
Mm-hmm.
Because something they did.
And even then, like, I'm sure whatever it was at 6 or 7, you know, isn't significant enough.
Yeah.
So they refer to their father as Daddy Bailey or Big Bailey, and he ends up paying a visit to Stamps. And honestly, the siblings are kind of shocked at seeing him, but they kind of, like, I guess, fantasized about what he looks like, their mother looks like, and things like that. But they see his car and they kind of start imagining his life without them, what it looks like. And they kind of believe that he's pretty wealthy, that he lives in like a giant castle out in California. She ends up learning that he is a doorman at one of the Santa Monica's really expensive hotels. And they refer to it almost as like he's worldly because he's traveled so much and he's been around. But they do also refer to his speech as being a little bit more proper. I believe the exact wording is proper English is how they refer to it as. And he basically spends there for a little bit, and at the end of his trip he decides that he's going to announce that he's taking the kids back with him. And Maya's not really excited to go. She thinks the thoughts of being separated from Bailey just is too much. Mama Henderson doesn't really have much of a reaction, so she just kind of starts making clothes for Maya, which is kind of weird to me, but at the same time, I don't think that she had any kind of custody, so really he could have come back at any point and taken them, and she really wouldn't have much way of saying it.
I would imagine there were probably conversations in the background that we weren't privy to, since Maya probably wasn't privy to them.
So on their way leaving, the dad decides that they are not going to California. They're going to stop in St. Louis to see their mother, which to me was weird. You're basically stealing the children away from their lifestyle they've lived, and then you're going to go visit your ex-wife and drop them off at basically her doorstep. But then she kind of starts like snowballing the issue with the fact of like, why her mom was too pretty to have children. Like, you know, that's why she abandoned her. I feel like the mother probably should have had a set down and was like, hey, kids, this is what's been going on, why you haven't been able to live with me. But I also wonder if it was pre-planned in advance between the dad and the mom for this to occur.
There were definitely a lot of things I would like to know about that. And part of the reason why I say that is because how we see mom act, mother, I think that's what they called her, later in San Francisco, didn't resonate with me and her in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seemed like two different women.
Yes.
And it might have been. Mom might have been a totally, you know, I mean, we change as we grow. So I don't know if that's intentional or if that's just how Maya viewed her. I don't know. But I agree that the St. Louis thing was random. And who knows? We're getting Maya's perspective, and obviously St. Louis was very traumatic for Maya. So for all we know, the trauma could have impacted how she viewed going to St. Louis as well. We don't know.
Viewed going to it, but then also her reflection on experience there. And then, you know, kind of maybe her descriptions, or maybe trauma has blocked out some of those memories that would have further explained it to us as well.
Yeah, it's very possible.
So we end up meeting her grandma and grandpa on her mom's side, and then we also end up meeting her three uncles, who are notorious for bad tempers. We end up coming across the wonderful Mr. Freeman, and that's extremely sarcastic, so nobody come after me for that.
I will say, I found it interesting the way that she recalls him and their interactions, and then like later on even the way she references him and stuff. I was impressed by that, by her resiliency and like the confrontation of that time period. I thought, well, I keep thinking it's going to be this guy. And so I didn't see Mr. Freeman coming.
To be honest, the little comments by her uncles, I kind of had a suspicion it was one of them, because it talked about, like, I think the quote was like, a good mind then a cute behind or something like that. And so I kind of had a worry that it was going to be him, but luckily it was not. At this point, I had suspected so many people that I kind of was a little apprehensive of accusing another one, I guess you can say.
Well, and the moment that I knew that it was him is the moment she says that her mom put her in bed with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, okay, here it goes.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but I felt really bad for her, because in that moment she does kind of mention that he was like a father figure and she was finally having the hugs of a parent and stuff like that. And then to know what he did to her was just, it was just disgusting. My biggest issue with all of it, outside of the actual occurrence of it, was kind of how everyone else responded to her after the fact. Like, nobody sat her down and was like, you know, this is not your fault. Like, you had no control over this. Like, don't be down on yourself. Like, nobody had the common decency to sit down and have that conversation with her. And I honestly don't know a single person in her life that could have been that person, because it seemed like everybody avoided talks about these kind of things. Like, it almost seemed like everybody just kind of put it in the past. And I don't know if that was predominant because of the time period, or if that was just kind of how her family took care of things.
Well, so for me, I really thought, like, after experiencing mom in San Francisco and some other topics like that with mom, I would have assumed mom would have addressed it.
It seems that it was after, like, not in this time period, but like later on in the book, it does seem she's very open to those kind of conversations and things. So I would have suspected that, but it doesn't seem like she ever got that conversation.
No, I agree. I don't know, because I feel like the conversation would have happened before she even had to testify. Also, I didn't realize there was actually like a trial and testimony and a conviction and all. I didn't realize any of that, actually. And I'm quite shocked, to be honest with you, because most of the time, especially with children, there really is no follow through.
Yeah,
especially like when she's talking about her testimony, I was already getting worked up. Let me just be honest. I was getting even more worked up when I was listening to how she was feeling through that testimony. And then when she said that was the only time or whatever. And I thought, oh, if he gets found not guilty. Mm-hmm. I just kept thinking, if one of her uncles don't kill him, they're like these big bad dudes. And like, why has no one taken him out yet? That's what I kept thinking. And then obviously they do finally. And I'm going to be honest, that was one of my favorite scenes. And I was like, it's about time. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Like, now she doesn't. I mean, was the year of a sentence satisfactory? Absolutely not. 1,000%. That was a terrible sentence for him.
Mm-hmm.
And is death too kind? Maybe. But she does not have to look over her shoulder. She does not have to wonder if he's going to pop up another day in a store or something like that. He's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be other monsters, I'm sure, but that one's gone. And yeah. So, I don't know. I just thought it's about time.
Yeah, I ain't going to lie.
Because if I was mama, I don't think I would have called the police. The mm-mm. first call after my daughter came out with bloody underwear would have been to my brothers, and no one else would have known nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna be honest, my brother wouldn't do that for me. It'd be me doing it. But that's what I would have done.
I mean, tomato, tomato. To me, it was really saddening. It was disgusting. It was uncomfortable for me as a reader. Let alone, I think, obviously for her, but then to not get anybody to address it throughout her life.
Even like when she goes back to Stamps, I was surprised Mama Henderson didn't have a conversation with her. And this, like, treating her poorly and like sending her back to Stamps to not be your problem because she's decided she doesn't want to speak is insane to me. I was very surprised by that. That's not how I thought the reaction would have been, especially after her uncles just went and murdered him. Maybe that's why they got frustrated, because they wanted her to talk about it and they wanted her to acknowledge it and she wouldn't, maybe. I don't know.
It's possible.
But she's also a child that just went through a horrible... And again, I don't want to go into any too many details either, but I don't know which one was worse. The first one where she almost like okayed it in her own brain because she also got the love and affection, which is such a manipulative, it's so angering.
Mm-hmm.
Or the brutality of the next one, like equally awful. Again, I'm just glad her uncle's killed him. I'm sorry, but I am.
I have no other comments to say, but you are absolutely not the only one.
Yeah, but then we begin her journey with her, and I, instead of saying like that she's mute, I almost kind of looked at it more as like she felt like she had lost her voice. Like she felt like she had been taken away from herself, made into something else, and she didn't know really what to do with it. And so she just stopped talking until she could figure it out.
Yeah.
Which is so sad.
I would agree. But I think the harder part for me, which I've never been in this type of situation, but the hardest part for me was that she did have people that believed her. And I mean, typically they don't, especially at that age, it's kind of hard, which I mean, or sometimes the parent will always make excuses and be like, oh, maybe she just started her period earlier. Some kind of like.
That's what reduction. I thought mom was going to say. I thought mom was going to assume that it was her period.
But I am so glad that she did not. Like, I'm glad that there was that stance. But it just, to me, at the same time, it was a little hard for me to not, especially in this time period, like women were so property and, you know, in many cases, they were not allowed to own anything or stuff like that. So I was really kind of shocked that A, it was a child, but B, it was a woman that they were allowing to accuse a man and they were agreeing with it. But it almost seems like her actual mother had a little bit of like a stance up in society as well, just by like the police officer that came by after, you know, he was killed. Like they kind of had some friendliness to them. So it almost seemed like, you know, maybe that's why, is they had some kind of, you know.
I also had that thought, which is something that as a child she wouldn't have had the wherewithal to even think about at that point. Honestly, she had much more pressing matters. But I did find that interesting.
And I don't know if it's just like, I don't know if it was like just people were afraid of them because they were Black. And because I know like in that one scenario with the dentist, it was almost a conversation that she had made up that had like, don't kill me. And it was almost like that kind of scariness in their brain or something. I don't know. It just, there was a lot of things that just were weird, but her uncles definitely seemed like they were some kind of mafia or some kind of like bad group.
I think they were 1,000% gangsters. Yeah, I got that vibe. It's St. Louis. I'm pretty sure they were.
Yeah, it just seemed like everybody was just kind of like, just let the boys do what they want to do. If they want to kill a man, just let them kill him. Like, no big deal. Like,
well, and I think the white police officer probably had the same thought that they didn't care if white men killed Black men. And so, like, they weren't really going to waste their time investigating a Black man killing another Black man. Like,
yeah.
They didn't care because it's the same. You know what I mean? Like, they should have.
She says something along that lines at some point. I don't remember the exact line she had used, but it was something like, I realized the differences in crimes. You know, if a white on white crime or white on Black crime is two different things, or if it's a Black on white, it's much bigger than Black on Black kind of crime. She says something to that extent at some point later in the book.
Okay, that's kind of what I assumed took precedent, but also it did sound like mama maybe or mother did have a couple of connections or something there.
Yeah, which could be her brothers, so.
I would say so.
Putting two and two together.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were gangsters. I'll use that word.
Definitely had some connections somewhere, yeah. Somehow. So she does end up returning to Stamps with her brother, and Mama Henderson kind of just ignores the subject, which Maya ends up kind of becoming more withdrawn. And then she starts like going down this rabbit hole of like wondering who knows about the rape and who thinks of her as sinful and dirty, is the words I believe she used. And just kind of trailed into this and spiraled. And I think that's part of what played into kind of her silence, was just, you know, her reluctantness to be able to move on from it. But it wasn't really her fault that she couldn't move on to it. It's just none of the adults were adult enough to address it with her. I mean, to me, if you're having such a hard time processing it as an adult, the child is having 10 times more harder time addressing it. So, like, talk to them about it. Maybe uncomfortable, but have a conversation. That's honestly the part that made me angry, like, the most.
Yeah.
But she does end up befriending a lady named Miss Bertha Flowers, who offers her kind of a world of knowledge, giving her some kind of formal education and just kind of giving her a little bit more of experience outside of what she's used to and kind of a different world to imagine. She starts giving Maya books to read and encourages her to read them out loud. She kind of introduces her to poetry. She speaks as to, you know, it was a kind of a way to get outside of herself and into a different world.
I have a quote that Miss Flower says to her about her not talking and stuff that I'd like to read. So the quote about her not talking is this: "Now, no one is going to make you talk. Possibly no one can. But bear in mind, language is a man's way of communicating with his fellow man, and it is language alone which separates him from the lower animals. Your grandmother says you read a lot, every chance you get. That's good, but not good enough. Words mean more than what is set down on paper. It takes the human voice to infuse them with the shades of deeper meaning." And then, aside from that, she also talks about what she calls lessons with Mrs. Flowers. And Maya says, "As I ate, she began the first of what we later called my lessons in living. She said that I must always be intolerant of ignorance, but understanding of illiteracy. That some people, unable to go to school, were more educated and even more intelligent than college professors. She encouraged me to listen carefully to what country people called mother wit, that in those homely sayings was couched the collective wisdom of generations." And then it says that she had heard poetry for the first time in her life. And she said, "I have often tried to search behind the sophistication of years for the enchantment I so easily found in those gifts. The essence escapes, but its aura remains. To be allowed, no, invited into the private lives of strangers and to share their joys and fears was a chance to exchange the southern bitter wormwood for a cup of mead with a beowulf, or a hot cup of tea and milk with Oliver Twist. When I said aloud, 'It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done,' tears of love filled my eyes at my selflessness." And, like, what? In the moment, she says here, like, in the moment, that it felt very profound and she felt like she was learning something. And I'm sure she did. I have no doubt that she really did take that into heart. But, like, what it meant for her going forward, even the way it grew and the way she could come back to it and all that sort of stuff, that was just, I just thought was really beautiful. And, like, she is, I don't know, this is the person that introduced her to poetry. And now she's a writer and she writes poetry. And she writes beautifully. And so, like, it's just like a full circle kind of moment. And I just thought it was really cool to see and hear and talk about. And I don't know. I just thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Also, well, I love the little lessons in living. We love any old lady will give a moment to have a, to pardon on their wisdom to
you. Yeah.
So that was always fun.
Well, and speaking of old ladies that want to give their opinions and things, but in the opposite direction, we end up meeting Miss Collins, but she is employed by her around age 10 to serve as almost like a maid.
The main lady.
Yeah. And so she has a habit of, like, calling her not by her name, but making up kind of different names.
Well, that made me so mad.
Yeah. Her coworker
called her kinda Mary because her name's too long.
Yeah.
You couldn't even call her, like, Margie. That, like, would go with Margaret.
Or Maya. Which,
yeah, or Maya. Which
she goes by. She says that she also, like, had renamed her coworker Miss Glory as well. And apparently her real name is Hallelujah, which was an odd name. I don't think I've ever heard that name before. But even Hallie, Hal, something like that would have made a little bit more sense. But I guess her corresponding in her head, it was Hallelujah. But I did find it very funny how she stuck it to her. And she basically just goes in and breaks all of her prized china. And so, of course, the woman gets very angry and ends up firing her. And at that point was the only time she actually uses her real name, and she or doesn't use her real name. She like tries to clarify that her name is Margaret, and again, it's not. So
is it Margaret?
Marguerite.
Okay. I knew it was spelled different.
Yeah, she kept calling her Margaret, but her name was Marguerite.
Okay. I got so tickled when I thought it was hilarious the way she corrected her, but then I got even more tickled thinking about, do you think that woman has read this book? Or one of her children have read this book and realized that it's her? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? I don't know. I hope they have.
Well, see, it says in there that she can't have children, so I doubt she ended up at this point having children, so.
She could have adopted.
Yeah, but she seems kind of on the older side based on how she described her.
Well, maybe her nieces and nephews. I don't know. Somebody was like, hey, that's old grumpy Mrs. C. Like, she was always a bitch. I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I get it too.
I think, though, like, first and foremost for me, like, what that was an example of, though, is she was calling her by her full name to start with. And then, even though she'd already changed Hallelujah to Glory, but then didn't suggest a new name until one of her friends pointed it out, which is a little confusing for me.
She was calling her Margaret instead of Marguerite.
I thought she was calling her her name.
Mm-mm. I'm pretty sure she was calling her Margaret, and whenever Miss Glory kept correcting it, was like, Marguerite, it's actually Marguerite, and she just kept saying, and then she ended up saying something about it being too long, so she's just gonna go by Mary.
Mrs. Cullinan. Is that
your guess is as good as mine?
I love and hear how often she says things like, white folks are so strange. Or like, when she goes into town for the first time and she sees a white person, she described what she thought they looked like. And, I mean, it's sad because of the context of the time and like the relations between white and black people. But like, just reading it like now is a little humorous.
So we do get kind of their first sense of almost freedom between Maya and Bailey. And so they start getting a allowance for helping out in the store. And Bailey decides to go and use that money to go to the movies. Maya ends up buying cowboy books with it. But there is one particular that Bailey does not return from the movies at the time he's supposed to. And so Mama Henderson gets kind of anxious and decides to go looking for him. And he ends up taking a whooping after he gets home, and he doesn't cry or complain, but he does end up saying that the actress he had seen in the movie was a white woman named Kay, who looks like their mother. And so they end up deciding to wait until the next movie that woman is in comes on screen, and they would go watch it together. They do end up going, and Maya's excited to realize that the movie star looks just like her mother, but Bailey is kind of becoming upset, withdrawn, and they decide not to tell Mama Henderson or Uncle Willie because they believe that this is like their way of being close to Vivian, and they didn't have, you know, enough of her to share with other people.
I would love to see a picture of her mom and that actress like in a color side-by-side picture so we could see if did they really look alike, or is there like one little thing that reminded him of mom and he was just yearning for mom so much that he thought, you know what I'm saying? Like, I just thought it'd be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Vivian Baxter is her name. I feel like that's a strong name.
So we do get this scene that I do want to talk about as well, where they are having like a store. People are like gathering in the store for a radio broadcast of a boxing match. And a black boxer is facing off against a white boxer. And the black man ends up winning. And so whenever the festivities are over, they're leaving and they're talking about how a lot of the people leaving the store had made arrangements to stay in town because that night they believed it was very unsafe for a black man and his family to be caught alone on a country road. And I did think that that was very important to kind of correlate that the fact that even though something so far off that was unrelated to them had happened because like at this time, some people in their mind just that means like it could be an uprising of black people over white people. There's so many insignificant events that at this time people corresponded who just wanted to wring out hatred would end up pouring down into some of these small towns or small areas that had no correlation. Like these people didn't train this man. These people didn't have anything to do with it. So it bothered me quite a bit.
I think it resonates even more for me. Like once we get to the graduation speech, mm-hmm. I can't imagine like the excitement of him winning, but then you have to like pretend you're not excited because you could be murdered because you're excited. Like the like absurdity of that, like you can't even celebrate, is insane, first of all. And then he went on to hold the champion for almost another 10 years. It is interesting to me to think about how it might have changed from year one to the last year or whatever, if there was a change. Honestly, I don't think there was much of one because it was still segregation years, but it would be interesting to think about. And how he lived and how he was impacted also by that victory. You know what I mean? Okay, I'm going to read the quote from chapter 18 real quick that I think like this scene too really resonates with this like self-righteousness and that like white people are right and black people are wrong in this time period or whatever. So anyways, it says, they basked in the righteousness of the poor and the exclusiveness of the downtrodden. Let the white folks have their money and power and segregation and sarcasm and big houses and schools and lawns like carpets and books and mostly let them have their whiteness. It was better to be meek and lowly, spat upon and abused for this little time than to spend eternity frying in the fires of hell. No one would have admitted that the Christian and charitable people were happy to think of their oppressors turning forever on the devil's spit over the flames of fire and brimstone. But that was what the Bible said, and it didn't make mistakes. Ain't it said somewhere in there that before one word of this changes, heaven and earth shall fall away? Folks going to get what they deserved. And I thought, it's very fitting, very accurate. And may they all get exactly what they deserve.
Yeah, I get you. So we end up getting into where at the school they start handing out Valentine's cards, letters, things like that. And she receives a letter from a boy named Tommy. And she ends up ripping up his note and throwing away because she is kind of weird about the situation. She's not quite sure how to receive it. And he ends up writing a card that ends up being read in front of the entire class, which I think is just kind of a violation of privacy. But he basically says, you know, even though it hurt his feelings, that she'll always be his Valentine, which we then don't ever hear about him again, right?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to say, I don't remember. I mean, maybe in one of the other short stories that she does, maybe he comes back around at some point. That's why she felt significant to mention it in this one. But as far as in this one, he doesn't come back around. I also want to talk about how Bailey was making had a tent where he basically...
Okay, hang on. Before we get into that whole thing, yeah. I just want to add that I thought it was really significant with the Valentine thing that Maya didn't know like what was age appropriate and normal behavior for young children, yeah. And him sending that Valentine. She said, what does he want to do with me? Like, what does he want from me? And it's so sad to me. The simple childhood crushes were ruined from that point forward because yeah. She doesn't have that context, and she has obviously much more context for adults, and that was really sad. But yeah, and then her brother, who was like 11, and him, I just was like, oh, he must, like, we must have jumped ages up, like he's 15 16. Then she says 11, and I was yeah. like 11,
yeah,
and this girl was like 16.
Yeah,
I was like, this well, little hoe.
It wasn't just one girl though, it was like multiple. Like, and they were playing like Mama and Papa or something like that,
but they were yeah. dry humping, so at yeah. least they weren't actually, you know, doing it. And yeah. then here comes this grown little girl and tells her to stand outside and watch, and then convinces him to put it in, and he's like, why are you taking your clothes off? She's like, what do you mean?
Yeah,
that was so weird.
Yeah, and then like
that felt like sexual assault too.
Yes, it did. And then like the girl was like, oh, run off and get some like firewood or something like that, and it was just like, I don't know, it was so weird.
It made me uncomfortable.
And then, like, Maya was almost, like, she kind of stepped in and she was like, no, don't, like, let her do that to you or whatever, thinking that he was being sexually assaulted. And which, I mean, he kind of was. Like, she thinks he needs to go to the hospital and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden she just, like, ghosts him, and he just, like, ghosts everybody in his life in the meantime. It was real weird.
Yeah. Well, and then he was, like, so heartbroken that she left.
Yeah.
And evidently this little girl was sleeping around with other people in the town, too, we found out.
Yeah, because she took off with some train guy or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So, which then made me wonder, too, like, what happened to her in her childhood that she's sleeping with a little 11-year-old boy?
Yeah.
Who, you know, I mean, you know they weren't doing that well.
No.
So, like, what the heck?
Yeah. I don't know. It was one of the weirder scenes, to be honest. And that's saying a lot, because there was a lot of weird scenes.
It was definitely strange.
So we end up having where some local guy named George comes to this door, and Mama ends up inviting him inside. And apparently his wife had died recently. And so she kind of like chit-chats with him and stuff. And it's almost like he keeps talking about ghosts coming to visit him.
It was strange.
It was real weird. I was just like,
I'm not gonna lie, I didn't really see the point of that scene.
No, and I was kind of like, other than just like to kind of emphasize like where her town was at, kind of with logic. I mean, that's what I took from it, is like kind of a basis off of her town and kind of where that comes from.
I thought it might have been something that becomes like significant later for like her spiritual journey or whatever. Maybe because we just read this one, we don't get the context for the rest of it.
Yeah.
Because there are multiple, in case y'all didn't know that. This is just part one of her like memoir of several books. So. Mm-hmm.
So we do end up where Maya is graduating from the 8th grade, and they have like a graduation ceremony.
The white man that comes to the ceremony?
Yeah.
He was...
politician, maybe?
I believe he is a politician.
Yeah, so he comes to give a speech, and basically I gather that they did a kind of like a song as what they consider the Negro National Anthem, and they end up skipping over a couple of those things, and apparently they had skipped it because of the white politician being there. And he starts talking about different changes and things like that coming to the district, and she talks about how basically all of her class was very disappointed in the changes, because all of the changes coming to the black school kind of emphasized towards them being like different roles in the community that were maids and farmers instead of more high esteemed positions, dentists, doctors, things like that.
Yeah, I wanted to read the part of the book, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Thought it was significant. And so she says, the white kids were going to have a chance to become Galileos and Madame Curies and Edisons and Goggins, and our boys, the girls weren't even in on it, would try to be Jesse Owens's and Joey Lewis. Owens and the Brown Bomber were great heroes in our world, but what school official in the white Gotham of Little Rock had the right to decide that those two men must be our only heroes? Who decided that for Henry Reed to become a scientist, he had to work like George Washington Carver as a bootblack to buy a lousy microscope? Bailey was obviously going to be too small to be an athlete, so which concrete angel glued to what country seat had decided that if my brother wanted to become a lawyer, he had to first pay penance for his skin by picking cotton and hoeing corn and studying correspondence books at night for 20 years? The man's dead words fell like bricks around the auditorium, and too many settled in my belly. Constrained by hard-learned manners, I couldn't look behind me, but to my left and right, the proud graduating class of 1940 had dropped their heads. Every girl in my row had found something new to do with her handkerchief. Some folded the tiny squares into love knots, some into triangles, but most were wadding them, then pressing them flat on their yellow laps. Graduation, the hush-hush magic, time of frills and gifts and congratulations and diplomas, was finished for me before my name was called. The accomplishment was nothing. The meticulous maps, drawn in 3 colors of ink, learning and spelling... I can't even say this word... decasyllabic words, memorizing the whole of the Rape of Lucrece, it was for nothing. Don Levy had exposed us. We were maids and farmers, handymen and washerwomen, and anything higher that we aspired to was farcical and presumptuous. Then I wish that Gabriel Prosser and Nat Turner had killed all white folks in their beds, and that Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated before the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and that Harriet Tubman had been killed by that blow on her head, and Christopher Columbus had drowned in the Santa Maria. It was awful to be Negro and have no control over my life. It was brutal to be young and already trained to sit quietly and listen to charges brought against my color with no chance of defense. We should all be dead. I thought I should like to see us all dead, one on top of the other, a pyramid of flesh with the white folks in the bottom as the broad base, then the Indians with their silly tomahawks and teepees and wigwams and treaties, the Negroes with their mops and recipes and cotton sacks and spiritual sticking out of their mouths. The Dutch children should all stumble in their wooden shoes and break their necks. The French should choke to death on the Louisiana Purchase, 1803, while silkworms ate all the Chinese with their stupid pigtails. As a species, we were an abomination, all of us. The ugliness they left was palpable. An uninvited guest who wouldn't leave. The choir was summoned and sang a modern arrangement of Onward Christian Soldiers, with new words pertaining to graduates seeking their place in the world. But it didn't work. Eloise, the daughter of the Baptist minister, recited Invictus, and I could have cried at the impertinence of the I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul. My name had lost its ring of familiarity, and I had to be nudged to go receive my diploma. All my preparations had fled. I neither marched up to the stage like a conquering Amazon, nor did I look in the audience for Bailey's nod of approval. Marguerite Johnson, I heard the name again. My honors were read. There were noises in the audience of appreciation, and I took my place on the stage as rehearsed. I thought about colors I hated. Ecru, puce, lavender, beige, and black. There was shuffling and rustling around me, and then Henry Reed was giving his valedictory address, to be or not to be. Hadn't he heard the white folks? We couldn't be. So the question was a waste of time. Henry's voice came out clear and strong. I feared to look at him. Hadn't he got the message? There was no nobler in the mind for Negroes because the world didn't think we had minds, and then they let us know it. Outrageous fortune? Now that was a joke. When the ceremony was over, I had to tell Henry Reed some things. That is, if I still cared. Not rub, Henry, erase. Ah, there's the erase. Us. To be a man, a doer, a builder, a leader, or to be a tool, an unfunny joke, a crusher of funky toadstools. I marveled that Henry could go through with the speech as if we had a choice. Henry Reed starts to do the, I believe she referred to it as the Negro National Anthem, and he does like the actual every single word correctly and from the beginning, and she says that was the first time that she had ever actually listened to the words and felt them. And she said, but I personally had never heard it before, never heard the words, despite the thousands of times I had sung them, never thought they had anything to do with me. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. The tears that slipped down many faces were not wiped away in shame. We were on top again. As always, again, we survived. The depths had been icy and dark, but now a bright sun spoke to our souls. I was no longer simply a member of the proud graduating class of 1940. I was a proud member of the wonderful, beautiful Negro race. Oh, black known and unknown poets, how often have your auctioned pains sustained us? Who will compute the lonely nights made less lonely by your songs, or by the empty pots that made less tragic by your tales? If we were a people much given to revealing secrets, we might raise monuments and sacrifice to the memories of those poets. But slavery cured us of that weakness. It may be enough, however, to have said that we survive in exact relationship to the dedication of our poets, include preachers, musicians, and blues singers. I got so emotional that the children even had to experience that in the first place, obviously.
Yeah.
I'd love to know who this man actually was. And I'd like to know what Henry Reed went on to be. I would love to know his story. But just sadness, like just reading that they even had to sit there on their big day. I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
Then to turn around even as a child and say, no, you're not. We'll be something. This is the strength and courage that I had to have taken to stand up there as a child to do that too. Like, ugh. That scene was probably once in this entire book. It was really good.
Well, I have to say the one that most significantly kind of put into realization for me was the dentist scene where Maya had some cavities and they had taken her to Texarkana to get some teeth pulled. And Mama goes to this doctor and, of course, they have to go in through the back door because of the time period we're in. And the guy was just like, nope, treat color people. And Mama was like, well, you know, I helped you out during the Great Depression. And it just pretty much like it was just like disregarded. Like, you, I helped you out, but you pay me back. Like, it's no big deal. Like, it was just, I don't know. It was so sad. And it was just like so drastic because obviously Maya's young, she's in pain. And I mean, this guy doesn't even want to help, but like, he almost seems sorry that he didn't want to help. So I don't know if, like, to me, my thought was, oh, there must've been somebody of importance in his office that he didn't want to be caught doing that. And that was my thought. But at the same time, because obviously, like, it seemed like she had been there before and had gotten treated there before and never had a problem kind of thing. So,
yeah, I didn't understand that, if that was the first time or what exactly was happening there. Because he did seem sort of sympathetic to someone, not necessarily her, but someone else that she knew or something.
Yeah.
But, like, in front of his staff, he won't do it or something. Maybe like that, you know, because word spreads and then,
yeah,
you know, whatever.
Well, and see, my thought is, though, there had to have been some kind of, like, interaction before, because obviously he felt comfortable enough to go to Mama about borrowing money. So yeah, he had to have some kind of relationship with her to some extent to feel comfortable enough to do that, but
I just assumed because she was a store owner, that's why he went to her, because he could get supplies from her.
Possibly.
But no, I agree. I wanted, there had to be some other sort of context back there, I felt like. I will say of that scene, I love Maya's version.
Yeah.
And then we find out what
like
that was.
Yeah, she seems like a mob boss. Like,
yeah, she did.
Like, I'm going to kill you if you don't pay my money.
I love that. And I love the, like, again, it's actually quite morbid, but, like, allowing her imagination to take her out of that situation and creating a different story of, like, what happened to avoid the trauma of the fact that he was refusing them service. Yep. That was an interesting take. But obviously, he's a coward, and I hope his business got shut down. Burned down.
Yeah, I think the threat that in her version, she'd said, like, get out of this town and never operate here again or something like that.
I liked that.
Are you constantly feeling guilty about spending so much money on buying your favorite books, Carl and M's recommendations, or book trophies? Worry no more with Book Outlet. Books are up to 75% off. Inventory changes daily, but the prices are consistent. Check our link in the description and you'll have access to a coupon for $5 off your next purchase. Mama decides that Bailey and Maya need to go back to California. Basically, a chain of events starts happening that puts into perspective that their life may be at risk or their safety. Bailey was at school one day and he comes home shocked because he was forced to retrieve a dead body of a black man from a pond. And the next morning, Mama was like, hey, we're sending you to California. She ends up being arranged to go first, and then Bailey ended up joining them afterwards. She's kind of upset and everything because obviously she's going to leave the few friends that she does have, but Mama's to the point where safety is more important than friendships.
Yeah, that scene was insane.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was just because it was a black man so they didn't want to touch him, or like what the exact significance of why they had children go and pull a guy from a pond, but
because they're evil.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
I will say, though, I wanted to read this, and this is a quote when she tells them that she's taking them to California. She says, "We have a saying among black Americans which describes Mama's caution. If you ask a Negro where he's been, he'll tell you where he's going. To understand this important information, it is necessary to know who uses this tactic and on whom it works. If an unaware person is told a part of the truth, it is imperative that the answer embody truth. He is satisfied that his query has been answered. If an aware person, one who himself uses the stratagem, is given an answer that which is truthful, but bears only slightly, if at all, on the question, he knows that the information he seeks is of a private nature and will not be handed to him willingly. Thus, direct denial, lying, and the revelation of personal affairs are avoided." That was like such a, I felt like a random quote in there before telling us they're going to California. And it, like, to me, kind of became like relevant later in the story, but even like not fully, like I feel like that might be explored later on in the other books maybe too. But it felt a little bit of like a random quote, but I liked it. I liked that sort of distinction.
Well, I have to say, whenever they do get to San Francisco area, their mom ends up marrying who they call Daddy Clydell, I believe is how we pronounce it. But he's like supposedly a successful businessman, and it seemed like he ran schemes, is what my summary of what she described was.
If he wasn't a con man, he hung out with con men.
Yeah, yeah,
for that's sure. For sure. There's another quote that I want to read that her mom says that got me really tickled before we get into Daddy Clyde and his con man friends. So it says, with all her jollity, I can't even say that word, Vivian Baxter had no mercy. There was a saying in Oakland at the time, which, if she didn't say it herself, explained her attitude. The saying was, sympathy is next to shit in the dictionary, and I can't even read. Her temper had not diminished with the passing of time, and when a passionate nature is not eased with moments of compassion, melodrama is likely to take the stage. In each outburst of anger, my mother was fair. She had the impartiality of nature with the same lack of indulgence or clemency. I thought that was so funny to, like, set us up for, like, this image of her mom, especially because, like I said earlier, too, in the episode, the difference in her mom in San Francisco versus her mom in St. Louis was, like, two different people.
Yes.
And so, but that saying is so funny, and, like, I need to, like, put that on a piece of art and hang it up in my house or something. I love that. But, anyways. Yeah, she marries Daddy Clydell or whatever.
Yeah.
And he absolutely is at least friends with the con man if he's not a con man himself.
Yeah, I was a little nervous that, like, because oftentimes whenever, especially somebody so young is sexually abused, it ends up happening again and again with men in their life. And they were talking about how, like, close she was becoming with him and things like that.
Yeah.
I was getting a little nervous that it may happen again. I'm glad to learn that it didn't, at least in this context.
I agree.
But he does teach her some, like, card tricks and some, like, different kind of tricks of the trade, I guess you can say. But he basically refers to himself as a successful businessman without any formal education. And so Maya kind of appreciates, you know, his humility and entrepreneurial spirit that he has. But she basically, we also get the perspective of how, based on races and who commits that crime, how the law is interpreted. Mm-hmm. She talks about how basically, you know, if a Hispanic person commits a crime, what their kind of crime would result with the interpretation of the law, or a white person, or a black on black crime, or a white on black crime, or a black on white crime. Like, all of it was different as she described it. And as we know, still in some places to this day, is still the case. She talks about how it was just basically not streamlined across the board. So we also get Bailey Sr. back into the kind of the picture. He starts talking about how successful he is and things like that. So she ends up going to stay with him for a little bit. And she's been imagining he lives in this magnificent mansion and, you know, it's something fantastic. We end up finding out that he actually lives in a trailer park on the outskirts of town. And he has a girlfriend named Dolores that absolutely hates Maya's guts just for existing. But kind of one thing leads to another. They end up going to the border, which sounds kind of like her dad was transporting illegal items back and forth across the border, and he was also crossing the border basically to have an affair. And it was a lot, because there was also the scene where the guard at the crossing where he basically, like, offers his 15-year-old daughter up, and the guard was like, oh, you know, that we would have plenty of babies. Like, it was real weird.
I got real concerned at that point.
Yeah, to me, the dad just seemed like a piece of junk. I mean, to sit there and even make that kind of joke is just honestly disgusting. So
it is. I wholeheartedly agree. And I thought, oh my gosh, if he takes her down here and she gets sexually assaulted again,
or he, like, sells her or something like that,
I'm gonna,
yeah. And she even has a panic moment where she thinks that her dad had left her at the bar, and she thinks that guy is gonna sneak up and come for her or whatever. But then her dad gets massively drunk. She ends up having to drive across the border and ends up in an accident, and he somehow talks them out of doing anything about it. It was so weird.
It was strange.
Such a weird, like, interaction. And I definitely wouldn't say it was a daddy-daughter bonding trip by any means. Real weird.
No, I probably wouldn't go back to Mexico after that.
Absolutely not.
Be like, am I on a watch list somewhere?
Home. All of a sudden, Dolores, like, starts calling her mom a whore and, like, slaps her. And then Maya, like, slaps her back, and there was just, like, some kind of struggle. And then all of a sudden, Dolores has got a hammer and running after Maya.
It's crazy.
I don't know. It was an intense two chapters. I was just like, I don't know what's happening. But then all of a sudden, like, her dad doesn't want to take her to the hospital and takes her to some like weird house and then like to get stitched up.
Then takes her to another weird house to stay on her own.
Yeah. Well, nobody's living there too.
It was creepy. I didn't like it. Other than like then she ends up in the junkyard for a month or whatever and she learns things about herself there that we don't really explore anyways, but she just mentions it. I didn't really see the point of that other than us getting like closure that like clearly her dad's not doing any better.
Yeah.
But it was a little strange. And I just kept thinking, please go back to your mother.
Yeah.
Your dad is obviously not a parent. Well, and his girlfriend could catch his hands.
Well, and I would love to know whether or not they actually stayed together or not, that girlfriend and Bailey season.
No, I think she says he married someone else.
Okay.
Yeah.
It would just be interesting to know. But my thing is, was nobody worried about where she was? I mean, because it just seems like she basically calls up her mom and then all of a sudden they're happily ever after, back together, you know, in California. I don't know. It was strange. I don't know. And it just made me feel more sad for her. Just like that.
I agree.
It just didn't seem like anybody cared to actually look at her and be like, hey, there's a problem. We need to like address it kind of thing.
I agree. It seemed like everybody else was too preoccupied with their own problems.
Yeah. And then Bailey starts like hanging out with a prostitute.
I don't know.
And then he like goes to get a job on the railroad and leaves her. And so, like, Maya feels, like, super lonely. But then she's bound and determined to get on at a railroad company. But then her mom encourages her to skip school to go work at the railroad company. I don't know. It was weird.
That's a great question. I don't know. It was very strange. I think that kind of hints at the way that Black children had to grow up.
Yeah.
Very quickly. They experienced things they never should have experienced, and so they lost their innocence and their, you know, their nativity with the world very early on. I think that kind of hints at that. To be quite frank, and I'm not talking bad about Maya's mother at all, but once they got to San Francisco, there were things where the school still treated her differently, and applying for the job still treated her differently, and things like that. But there were ways that I didn't think, like going to her dad's for the summer, her mom not checking up on her and stuff like this man's never been dad. So, like, I would have been concerned. But yeah. I guess she also lived separate from her for so long when she lived with grandma, dad's mom, who's obviously capable. So maybe she just assumed dad was too. But I don't know. I feel like,
but also,
and maybe dad lied. Maybe dad was like, yeah, she's here doing well. Like, maybe dad never told mom that she lived. I don't know. But it just,
she also, it seemed though, she never, mom never really was like mom to her either. So maybe she was like trying to just pass her off for the, you know, the summer to go hang out with dad or something along that line. So that way she could go back to, you know, gallivanting the world like she was, kind of thing.
Well, yes, but no. I mean, there were moments in San Francisco where she was like mom.
Yeah.
I will say in St. Louis, we don't get that at all. Now, whether that's because just what part of the story was told, we don't see it, I don't know.
Yeah.
But she definitely seemed like two different women from St. Louis to San Francisco. And I know I've said that several times, but
no,
like,
I agree.
She actually seemed like a mom and like cared about him in San Francisco. So I don't know. It was a little strange for me to like that she does end up gallivanting and like mom never knows about it. Who knows if mom even knew before she died, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. And then like nobody talks to her about sex after everything that's happened to her. No one has a conversation with her and she ends up sleeping with that boy and getting pregnant at 16. Yeah. And that's obviously not in her best interest, not in anybody's best interest. So one little conversation might have helped us avoid that. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just seemed like there were ways, again, and I don't want to talk about her mom, but I feel like there were ways that we could have protected her a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think they, I don't want to say failed her, but I think they could have done a little bit better in some areas.
I agree. I think they all had intentions of, like, I don't want to say passing them off, but basically putting them in a situation that may have been best for them at that time. But at the same time, in doing that, it was almost just like passing them off back and on to each other, almost like they were a burden instead of allowing them to be the children that they were. Because honestly, they're not going to have consistent parenting. They're not going to have consistent rules to follow. They're not going to have consistent, you know, don't do this, yes, do this, but then somebody else is saying, but you can do this, that this other person told you you can do. You know what I mean?
Wait, that's like dad taking her to Mexico.
Yeah.
Mama in Arkansas, Mama and Grandma never would have allowed that. Yeah. She said, are you crazy?
Yeah.
You know, but like, I don't know. But I still felt like, and I don't blame her actual mother for what happened in St. Louis. Yeah. You can't, you don't know those things until they happen, obviously. Yeah. And when it did happen, she took full responsibility and took care of her and got him out and whatever else. So I don't blame her for that. But I just feel like there were other ways that we could have protected her a little bit more. I do understand, though, like not wanting to coddle your children, especially black children, in this day and age, because the world is so hard and rough on them already. But at the same time, like, still feel like there were ways we could have maybe coddled a little bit better. So at least at home, they knew. You know, I don't know.
I think a lot of, like, basically something happens, we just ignore it and don't talk about it is kind of how they all live their lives.
Well, because every day you'd be talking about something else, I'm sure.
Yeah. But I think all of that together, like, just not talking about the main problems. I mean, she knew later on that, like, the Ku Klux Klan were a thing. And she knew later on that she'd been sexually assaulted and stuff like that. But, I mean, in the moments, none of that was presented to her. So she, you know, had all those internal feelings that she was the problem for so long because of all of that. So,
yeah, I just keep coming back to Dad making that comment about her at the guard booth that, like, there was nothing he could do after that to make up for it. To even make that joke after knowing that she's been sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And also leaving her vulnerable in a foreign country, basically, while you're passed out drunk.
Where she doesn't speak the language.
She has no idea how to drive.
They could have been giving her alcohol for all you would have known.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I was like, he gotta go. I didn't like him. Okay, so I want to end on this quote. To be left alone on the tightrope of youthful unknowing is to experience the excruciating beauty of full freedom and the threat of eternal indecision. Few, if any, survive their teens. Most surrender to the vague but murderous pressure of adult conformity. It becomes easier to die and avoid conflicts than to maintain a constant battle with the superior forces of maturity. Until recently, each generation found it more expedient to plead guilty to the charge of being young and ignorant, easier to take the punishment meted out by the older generation, which had itself confessed to the same crime short years before. The command to grow up at once was more bearable than the faceless horror of wavering purpose, which was youth. The bright hours when the young rebelled against the descending sun had to give way to 24-hour periods called days, that were named as well as numbered. The black female is assaulted in her tender years by all those common forces of nature at the same time that she is caught in the tripartite crossfire of masculine prejudice, white illogical hate, and black lack of power. The fact that the adult American Negro female emerges a formidable character is often met with amazement, distaste, and even belligerence. It is seldom accepted as an inevitable outcome of the struggle won by survivors and deserves respect, if not enthusiastic acceptance. There were a lot of great quotes in this book, but that is one of my favorite, and I think a great way to end this.
So what is your final thoughts and ratings?
So I think I said this with Jeanette's book, but I personally just feel like I have to give this book a 5. I cannot read through someone else's struggle, particularly bad struggle, and not be, I'm going to get emotional. I'm not going to do this. Hang on. And not be moved and not want to learn more about it and not, especially from her perspective. And again, we said this with Jeanette's book too. The audiobook is read by Maya and it is such an intimate experience to listen to her telling her story.
Mm-hmm.
So highly, highly recommend that. But yeah, I would absolutely give it a 5. There were some parts that I don't fully see the full meaning of them because I haven't read the rest of the book. So maybe that would help me do that. But I still have to give it a 5 because just each step of the way and knowing that this probably isn't in the full extent even of the trauma that she experienced because mm-hmm. this is a little bitty book. And I mean, she had years and years, day by day, what happened. So that's mine. What is yours?
So my ranking system starts at 3, goes up and down from there. I would say for me, it was probably like a 4.5. maybe 4.6. I thought there was quite a bit of scenes that I found irrelevant to kind of the conversation. Obviously, she found it relevant. So, like, obviously, she felt like it impacted her story. And it may, to be honest, a lot of that may impact future autobiographies that she wrote, you know, more current ones. But to me, in this context, there was quite a few chapters that we probably could have done without, you know, as far as significant wise. However, there was really good written scenes for the chapters that were significant that displayed both not only herself, but her family, her race, all of their stories and kind of, you know, what they went through during this time period and things like that. I mean, it was hugely impactful, I think, you know, to read from her perspective, kind of a firsthand account of what all she experienced. But I do think that there was several places that it could have been wrote a little bit different or, you know, changed up or whatever, but it was super engaging and super impactful.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. So if you liked this episode or any of our other episodes, please subscribe to get access to bonus episodes randomly throughout each month or on the fifth Friday if there is one. We also have extra content, community chat, and more on Patreon. You can also find our free episodes on the first and third Fridays on any podcasting platform.
You can also send us book suggestions, comments, or general inquiries to our email at likewereadthem@carlmpodcast.com. You can also subscribe now on Patreon to get our monthly newsletter. You can also join us on Fable, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram for more engagement from us and the latest news. Carl, do you want to let us know what our next read is?
Actually, I'll be announcing two. So our next bonus episode comes out January 31st, and it is a recap of Iron Flame and Fourth Wing. It will probably mainly be talking about like fan theories and what we thought then, what we think now. But that sort of was like a preparation for our next episode, which will be February 7th, and it will be Onyx Storm by Rebecca Yarros. I'm going to hold up a picture of the book because obviously I don't have the real thing in front of me. And the blurb for that book.
There's multiple versions of the blurbs.
I'm reading Amazon's. Okay, so after nearly 18 months at Besgaeth War College, Violet Soringale knows there's no time for lessons, no more time for uncertainty. Because the battle has truly begun, and with enemies closing in from outside their walls and within their ranks, it's impossible to know who to trust. Now Violet must journey beyond the failing Aurician wards.
Yeah.
Okay. To seek allies from unfamiliar lands to stand with Navarre. The trip will test every bit of her wit, luck, and strength, but she will do anything to save what she loves. Her dragons, her family, her home, and him. Even if it means keeping a secret so big it could destroy anything. They need an army, they need power, they need magic. And they need the one thing only Violet can find. The truth. But a storm is coming, and not everyone can survive its wrath. That might be the first time I've actually fully read that and like
I don't want to know who dies.
I'm shook.
Unless it's Jack, I don't want to know who dies.
Oh, and it won't be Jack, unfortunately.
I know.
Okay, well, so we appreciate you tuning into this episode. We can't wait to hear your thoughts on it, and we hope that you will tune into our next episodes and subscribe on Patreon. Don't forget you can join us over on Fable to discuss each book as we read it, and as always, we promise to Carl them like we read them.